This is an ABC podcast.
Tim Watts is a Member of Parliament for the seat of Gellibrand in Melbourne's western suburbs. It's one of the most multicultural areas of Australia. Whenever Tim attends a citizenship ceremony on Australia Day in his electorate, he's struck by the myriad of places that the new citizens have come from. And he says some are so happy to have found sanctuary in Australia for their families that they actually weep with relief during the ceremony. Tim Watts comes from an old, old Anglo-Australian family. His ancestors were country people from the Darling Downs in Queensland and from Victoria as well. Some served as members of the colonial parliaments, and Tim grew up hearing the family folklore. He got bush poetry, and he fell in love with that old Australia and its myths and legends. But he's since realised that some of his ancestors who went into public life did everything they could to make sure that his wife and kids today could never be Australians. Tim says Australians still live with a powerful contradiction between the way we are, the way we live today, and the stories that we tell ourselves about who we are. And his own family personifies this contradiction. Tim Watts has written a very thoughtful book about Australia then and now, and it's called The Golden Country, Australia's Changing Identity. Hello, Tim.
Great to be with you, Richard.
You grew up in the Darling Downs of Queensland. Just how much were you kind of inculcated with the old Australian culture?
I was weaned on it, Richard. My father is an agricultural engineer, and that necessitated a lot of travelling on school holidays. You know, we'd travel to agricultural properties, building dams and feedlots and piggeries and those things. And those car trips were quite long ones in country Australia. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the long family road trip. Mm. And, you know, they were an opportunity with a captive audience to pass down the family folklore.
Dad had you trapped in the car, did he, essentially? Yeah.
I have many memories of being stuck in the back of a station wagon or four-wheel drive, sort of sweating in the back seat while Dad said, you know, well, this is the property where your great-great-great-grandfather was a pastoralist, or this was the property where, you know, one of your ancestors was enlisted to go to Gallipoli or was one of the first Qantas pilots. So, you know, that Australian legend I was really weaned on, and really weaned on the idea that I was a part of that Australian legend, you know, that my ancestors were part of this pioneering idea of starting a country again in Australia. So when I heard about, you know, the Australian legend, those values of egalitarianism, mateship, the fair go, you know, that they really appealed to me. Like, I felt like this was part of who I was. Like, I grew up really loving the idea of Australia.
I grew up with parents like that. So my dad from country Victoria, mum from country South Australia, a lot of those old Australian values, egalitarianism, you know, don't get tickets on yourself, all that stuff. The thing I really liked was the humour and the storytelling. Did you get plenty of that as well?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I can remember listening to Macca and Australia All Over, driving around the scrub, and, you know, the wags that would call in with some quite bizarre stories, you know, from these sort of towns with two cats and a dog and, you know, I swear it's true type things. And as a kid, it all sounds real, you know, it's all believable. And, you know, you'd pull up at a campground, and I sort of love the egalitarian manners of Australia. You know, you pull up at a campground, you start a conversation with the people in the tent next to you and the car next to you, and, you know, yarning over a few beers and a barbecue with people you've never met before. It's magic. It's really special.
Did you get the bush poetry as well?
Oh, I loved it. In fact, when I was having my first extended period away from Australia, living in the US, studying over there in the freezing cold snow of a North American winter, I can remember trudging back to my student accommodation and reciting Banjo Paterson to me from memory, you know, Clancy the Overflow, you know. I'd written him a letter, which I had, for want of better knowledge, sent to him just on spec.
So that's your family. That's your family. You're brought up with all that and all the values of that old Australia. Tell me what you learned about your ancestor, John Watts, because he was spoken of quite a bit in this time.
Yeah, John was a really significant person in my family. I mean, when I grew up, we always had a portrait of him, you know, with his fantastic white flowing beard that would not be out of place in my hipster inner city electorate today. Yeah. And he was significant because we had a copy of his diaries. So, you know, we could pick up his diaries and read what his experiences of Australia were like in the sort of the 1850s, 60s, all the way through to the 1890s. So we had that kind of first-hand connection that we could read. And that was really special, particularly to my father and my uncle, who, you know, republished them for the bicentenary.
What kind of a story of Australia was he telling in his diaries?
it's the old story of Australia. So he talks explicitly about, you know, the colonialist breed. And to situate him, you know, listeners might have heard of Steele Rudd, you know, the great Australiana author. On our selection, Dad and Dave. Well, Steele Rudd was born in the area of Queensland that my ancestor represented while he was the Member of Parliament there. So his diaries tell this story of Anglo settlement of Australia from a very, a terra nullius perspective. You know, in his mind, there was nothing of any worth in Australia when he arrived. And his diaries end with this sort of statement of, you know, and when I left, you know, Brisbane was a thriving metropolis type thing. Mm-hmm. But it was a very narrow perspective of what Australia was and could be.
That uncomplicated love you had for Australia as a young man, did that get a bit more complicated as you got older?
Yeah, the uncomplicated love changed when I started to see that those egalitarian values that I loved so much weren't extended to everyone in our society. So obviously to women, Indigenous Australians, migrants. And, you know, you talk about the stories we tell. It's interesting, the stories that John Watts tells in his diary sort of elide a lot of the darker parts of that history. So,
well, just step around it.
Yeah, they step around it. So,
or step over it, I suppose, yeah.
Or forget it. Pretend that it didn't happen. Right. You know, like I know that John Watts, when he was in Parliament, sat on a parliamentary inquiry into the conduct of the Queensland Native Police. Now, this is a sort of paramilitary force that existed in Queensland and was responsible for countless massacres. And in the Hansard, talking about that, John Watts says that, well, look, you know, the Native Police, they did some things that weren't very pretty, but probably better than just letting the pastoralists go at it themselves. That would be even uglier. And at the end of the day, I think the direct quote is, we need to teach the blacks the mastery of the whites through the power of the carbine. Now, that appears in the Hansard, but it doesn't appear in the diaries that he handed down to his future generations.
That's like something a Nazi would write. That's an extraordinary thing to say. We had to send in the SS.
It's horrifying. And that kind of thing gives you a direct connection with the atrocities, the injustices that were committed against Indigenous Australians. So I felt that really acutely. That's a jarring thing. You know, these things that you were raised with, these things that were fundamental to you, all of a sudden you start viewing them through a different prism.
So what do you want to do when you see something like that? Do you just want to throw it away or interrogate it a bit harder? What do you do when you read something, an ancestor saying something like that?
Yeah, well, the instinctive action from most Australians, I think, is to pretend it didn't happen, to sort of sweep it under the carpet. It's sort of the great forgetting, it's known in historical circles. For me, I think those are moments that are really worth delving into because they show the potential for us as a people and as a nation to change. You know, we've grown since those days. You know, there is still extraordinary injustice. And I see that the gap between Indigenous Australia and the rest of the country in terms of outcomes on health and education and crime all the time in my day job, it's horrific and it's ongoing. But in attitudes, we've come an extraordinary way in the last 2 years. We're a greater country now than we were back then.
You had another ancestor, Charles Nantes, his name was. Tell me about him.
Yeah, so Charles Nantes is one of those great pioneering stories. So he was a 19-year-old on the first fleet out to South Australia. And it's actually a famous historical incident that involved Charles Nantes. When they came around into what is now South Australia, the original intent was to have the settlement on Kangaroo Island, not in Adelaide. And they found Kangaroo Island, and my 19-year-old ancestor convinced the captain and sort of 10 other shipmates to say, we've been on the ship for however many months, we need to stretch our legs, so let us off. We want to have a gallop on Kangaroo Island because, you know, people had told them that Kangaroo Island was quite a nice place, you know, like a hospitable place where you could have a settlement. Unfortunately, for those who know Kangaroo Island, it's not like that. And they were lost there for 10 days. Two of them died. Charles Nantes was left for dead on a beach. And he was lucky enough that the surviving members of his party who sort of continued on down the island found the ship and sent them back for him. So they rescued him, which is probably a good thing for my family line, I suppose.
So then he settled in Geelong in Victoria after that. And what became of him once he settled there?
Yeah, so Nantes reinvented himself in Geelong as a businessman. He was a member of the first Geelong City Council. But the thing that really interested me in his legacy was that he was also a member of the local anti-Chinese league. Now, these were a common community organisation that was set up during the Gold Rush era with the intent of pressuring government and agitating public opinion with the objective of driving the local Chinese community out of Australia. You know, in the gold rush eras in Australia, the proportion of the Australian community who were born in China is about what it is today, nationwide. But this was the interaction between the whites, the Anglos on the gold fields and the Chinese triggered a lot of a flare back, a lot of conflict.
So what was the upshot of this? How did they actually succeed in stopping Chinese gold miners from coming to Victoria?
So I've got a copy of a petition that the Anti-Chinese League that Charles Nantes was a member of presented to the Victorian Parliament. And the objective of this petition was the creation of a poll tax. This is a charge on every Chinese arrival in a port in Victoria, quite extortionate charge. The intent wasn't that it would be paid. The intent was that it made it impossible for Chinese arrivals to disembark. And this triggered a quite extraordinary event. The ships coming from China didn't stop, but they continued around the coast outside Victorian jurisdiction to the nearest port outside Victoria. And that was the seaside town of Robe. Now, in Robe, around 17,000 Chinese migrants were dumped there, and they walked the 500 kilometres from Robe to the goldfields in Bendigo and Ballarat.
Walked 500 kilometres, right, all that way.
A quite harrowing walk. There's a lot of history that we know about that event now, and you can recreate the walk, as many people from the Chinese-Australian community do. And
so this is a thing amongst the Chinese-Australian community and remembered and all of that?
Yeah. It's a very well-known event in the Chinese-Australian community, and families recreate this for historical events, for anniversaries, things like that. And there are places you can stop along the way of significance.
So your ancestor, Charles Nantes, was one of the people sending that petition to the colonial government to prevent the Chinese from ever landing there. Now, today, your family, currently, your wife is born in Hong Kong, you've got Eurasian kids. I'm the same. I've got a wife born in Singapore. I have Eurasian kids as well. What does that do to you, the thought that you have an ancestor who wanted to create Australia where your family would never be possible, and your kids couldn't be Australians? What does that do to you, that thought?
Yeah, this was like an itch in the back of my mind. As we were talking about earlier, I felt this really strong connection with place and with Australia and with the idea of Australia as a kid growing up. And, you know, as my kids became old enough for me to entrap them in the back of car seats for long family road trips, it started to strike me that their experience of Australia's history and Australia's reality today would be different to my own. So that's something that I really wanted to explore, and as a member of parliament, as an elected leader, something I wanted to shape as well.
I mean, it's a troubling thought. It must have put you back on your feet a bit. I don't suppose I have the benefit of knowing much about what my ancestors thought. I know I had a grandfather who was a member of the Australian Natives Association, which was Australia for Australians. And that often meant no POMs as well. That was the attitude largely at the time, but that meant Australia for Australians. So I just wonder how personally distressing it is for you to know that.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I suppose I'll have that conversation with my kids when they're old enough, the way that they reconcile it. As I was saying earlier, I mean, I think that it really presents an optimistic story, you know, that...
How?
Well, it really shows how far we've come as a society, as a nation, that the anti-Chinese leagues, the idea of Australia for the white man, which was the strapline of the Bulletin that published all those great poems by Henry Lawson and Banjo Paterson, that we've transcended that, you know, conceptually.
I suppose on the one hand, one of the mistakes you can have with history is to shout at the past from the 21st century and say that, oh, by our moral standards, they just clearly fail to meet our moral standards of today. Still, even so, yeah, it's still quite troubling to see something like that. I mean, these views weren't uncommon at the time, like I say. So why was the feeling against Chinese migrants so strong at that time to create such petitions to do that kind of a thing?
So there are a few things in the water at the time. One of them was this sort of nascent attempt to build an Australian identity. You know, like, how are we different from the old world? How are we different from the English, as you said earlier? So you had associations like the Australian Natives Association, the Bush Poets, these people that were engaged in the symbolic nation building of Australia. And they had a really strong idea about what they wanted Australia to be. And it was really this image that of Russell Ward, a famous historian, talks about the Australian legend, this idea that what made Australia unique were the experiences of, you know, people working on the land in the face of extremely challenging conditions, in isolation, up against Mother Nature, And the view was that this created a band of people that sort of threw hierarchy out the window. You know, egalitarianism and mateship was something that was born from, you know, drovers swagging around and needing to band together to survive in this hostile environment.
And you can see them responding to the majesty of Australia too, can't you? Like, they're really struck by the beauty and that this is not England, this is not Scotland, this is not
absolutely.
Wales.
Absolutely, and that was a reflex, a reaction against British attitudes. You know, the British saw the Australian bush and were horrified. You know, like, this is a, how can anyone survive in this harsh country? And, you know, Australian patriots saw the Australian bush and said, this is the country we love. We see the beauty in it. You know, we were raised in it. So in that kind of mid-19th century period, people are trying to say, what, this is what it means to be Australian. Egalitarianism, mateship, the fair go, irreverence, you know, resilience, practicality, you know, all these ideas about a man in the land. And to define the edges, to contrast that with the other, with the Brits, we needed to create a stereotypical other. And unfortunately, the presence of the Chinese in the goldfields gave us that other. You know, we could typecast the Chinese as being servile, as being slaves, as being physically weak, as being morally corrupted. And you see this sort of engine that was defining Australian identity in positive terms also being used to typecast and negatively stereotype the Chinese who are present in our society.
So are you saying that in order to say we Australians are this, we needed to say we are not that?
That's
and
right.
That was the Chinese, essentially, as we were building up our national identity.
That's exactly right. And it wasn't a coincidence. You know, you saw events that were manufactured by political leaders and by writers and by groups like the Australian Native Association in order to highlight this.
There were some really amazing aspects to that character, that identity, the idea of egalitarianism. And, you know, it's often brought up and it doesn't diminish over time, and how brilliant Australians were in the prisoner of war camps in Thailand in the Second World War.
I really get irritated. Some people sort of like to say, oh, you know, there's no such thing as Australian identity or Australian values. You know, like, fundamentally, we're all humans and we share that common humanity, and there's not much that really differentiates ourselves in essence. But, you know, these Australian values, they have power, you know, and in the most extreme circumstances, Australians latch onto them. So in the prisoner of war camps, we've seen anthropological studies that show the different ways that Australians behave, the more collectivist, the more egalitarian ways, compared to, you know, say the Yanks or the Poms, right? Like, these values, this Australian culture, this Australian identity has value and has power.
It was said to be, and it was, a very blokey culture. And yet, at the same time, it was a culture where women won the vote early, right? You know, second only to New Zealand. I mean, women won the vote in Australia earlier than just about anywhere else in the world. So there was that as well. So there's a kind of a complex identity there, isn't there?
Absolutely. In that period before the First World War, there was this unique Australian identity of radical egalitarianism. You know, the heroes of Australian suffrage, you know, Vida Goldstein, Dora Mason, Muriel Matters, you know, they went across to the UK and lectured the mother country. They said, you know, you got to get with the times here. It was an extraordinarily bold, confident articulation of that radical egalitarian Australian identity.
There's kind of a lot of madness that goes into those early 19th century. You know, there's 19th century caricatures about the Chinese other that was over there. On the one hand, as you say, they're spiritually degenerate and they're physically weak, and yet they're a threat. Was that ever reconciled, that idea that the yellow peril was such a threat, and yet at the same time these physical specimens were supposedly so inferior to the Aussie bush male?
Yeah, so the way that was rationalised was sheer volume.
Right.
So the idea was that there were so many people to our north, and, you know, just like a one month's population increase in China would flood Australia. So there's this bizarre sphere of science fiction writing almost about race war in Australia that came in through that period. And they all focus on the sheer volume of people that come, you know. So in those dynamics, the hardy Australian bushman would go bush and, you know, Les Hidden style, and sort of survive off the land and fight this sort of guerrilla war against inferior but high in volume numbers of invaders.
How much does poor old Charles Darwin need to take the blame for this to some degree? Because poor old Charlie Darwin, he comes up with his theory of evolution. This led to this kind of 19th century thing that was really rife throughout the Western world, this idea of social Darwinism, that there was such a thing as race, which we know is scientifically not true. There was this idea of race, and that was that we're in this struggle for supremacy. And this is where Nazism comes from. It's where so much of the politics of the 19th century come from, is this idea that there's this race struggle. Is Australia really, I suppose, all that unusual in that sense for that time?
We were unlucky. And I say that because when this sort of social Darwinist idea came along, it had a special intrigue for Australians, because we convinced ourselves at the time, thanks to some pretty influential books that were written, that not only were we the sort of vanguard of the white British race, but we'd been hardened by the conditions of the Australian bush to, in some ways, produce a super race.
Oh, right.
So it was kind of turbocharged in Australia. I mean,
right. Yeah. So we were even better than the British then. Here we'd been
absolutely.
We'd been conditioned by the bush and the blue sky and the sunshine and all of that to be stronger, hardier individuals.
Absolutely, and there's a book by Charles Pearson that was very popular at the time that argued that the whites in Europe had become weakened by living in these sort of horrible industrial cities and no exposure to the land, and that Australia was sort of the vanguard of the white race. And these weren't fringe views, like in the debate about the Immigration Restriction Act in the Commonwealth Parliament, the predecessor to the White Australia Policy, or the legislative foundation for it. Australia's Prime Minister held a copy of that book while he was speaking. He quoted directly from it. So these were central to the thinking at the time.
And yet, there was another school of thought in Australia in this time. And this is where you get the title of your book from, The Golden Country. Tell me about the origins of that title.
Yeah, so there was always this sort of counter strain in the thinking that Australia could be a place where not only you start a country anew, but it's a place where sort of the best of the world could come together and to sort of blend and mix together and create something new and even more successful. And so the title of the book, The Golden Country, comes from an article in the Edinburgh Blackwood's Digest. It's a book of the time that talked about the potential for a golden Australia to emerge from the goldfields through essentially race mixing, right? Now, that was a peculiar thing. And as you say earlier, race isn't really a thing, right? So I'm not sort of trying to claim any racial determinism from taking that title. But the idea that Australia could be a place where the best in the world comes together and blends and produces something new and wonderful, that's an idea of Australia that really captured me.
It happened. I mean, that's what happened in the end. I mean, there's intermarriage in Australia. This is the thing that's undergirded our multiculturalism all the time. So in a way, do you see that as a kind of a prophetic statement about Australia that was kind of overlooked largely at the time?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Australians have had this very practical approach to multiculturalism. Donald Horne writes about it as early as the 60s in the Lucky Country. Sort of says Australians just manage on in their local community with difference and with new people, and they sort of get to know them and continue on, right? And I see that every day in my electorate. I mean, the success of Australian multiculturalism happens in our communities. You look at the job outcomes, the wage outcomes, community attitudes, migrant attitudes. Migrants report being happier than people born in Australia.
Really?
It's an extraordinary achievement. Like, we can be proud of that. Yeah. Like, it is not untrue to say that Australia is an incredible multicultural success story. There are caveats, but fundamentally very successful.
Still, in the end of the 19th century, as we're pushing ahead to become a federated nation, the colonies are going to join up to become a federated Australia. How was this fear of the yellow peril of the Chinese used to drive federation forward? Has it become an engine of federation, Tim?
Yeah, so the pre-federation era politicians, they used it as a rallying cry. They used it as a reason for federation. You think about people like Henry Parkes, They would manufacture these panics over the potential for invasion from the north, and the desire to have a unified immigration policy, a unified defence policy, was really animated by the threat from the north, and this was seen as an imperative for federation. So you look at the big figures of the time, like Alfred Deakin, is explicit. He says that there was no factor that was a greater motivator for the federation than the desire to preserve White Australia.
White Australia what did the Colonial Office in Britain make of this desire to make a White Australia?
Yeah, the Colonial Office by necessity needed to have a broader view, because the British had interests around the globe, and as a result of some peace treaties that they had negotiated, particularly with the Chinese, they had commitments around the world to open access to ports within the British Empire. So they weren't very impressed with these upshot Australian colonists saying, we want to have a racially exclusionary policy governing entry to this country, because it's inconsistent with their treaty obligations.
So this colonial office in London was telling Australia, don't go so hard on white Australia.
It was a constant source of friction, and something that colonial politicians used to grandstand in public. You know, say, oh, the Brits, they don't understand what we're up against here.
And what kind of threats were made?
Well, the most extraordinary one is Samuel Griffith, who is, you know, one of the architects of the Australian Constitution, one of our great jurists, who, when he was the Queensland Premier, threatened that if the colonial office didn't get with the program, Australia would go the way of the United States and, you know, violent revolution.
Samuel Griffith said, if the colonial office doesn't let us have white Australia, then we might rebel like the United States and become an independent nation.
And this is a bloke who has a conservative constitutional society named after him today.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
So, Tim, when you get to the establishment of the first federal parliaments, it meets in, 1901 or thereabouts, how much of a priority was white Australia for that parliament?
Well, it was the number one priority. After that, the Federation Parliament got done with the sort of the administrative things that they needed to do in setting up a country, you know, setting customs rates and things like that. The first issue of what Edmund Barton, our first Prime Minister, described as high policy that was debated by the Federation Parliament was a bill called the Immigration Restriction Act that we know now as the White Australia Policy. And this was an extraordinary debate. You know, the Hansard for this debate runs for hundreds of pages. And there were 89 members of Parliament that spoke in the debate, including five future Prime Ministers. And when you read that debate with sort of 21st century eyes, the language it's used in that debate wouldn't be out of place in a white supremacist forum on the internet today. Ugly stuff.
It's not even a debate, really. It sounds like it's hundreds of pages of furious agreement. All parties were on board.
No, it was a red-hot debate. It was a debate between whether we should outright exclude people who weren't white, just ban them, or whether we should have a dictation test that we could issue in any European language we chose to effectively ban people. Now, that was going back to the issue we talked about earlier with the colonial office from the UK. They were okay with a dictation test because that's what the South Africans had in Natal. And it was a way that you could sort of hide your blushes and practice racial discrimination, in effect, without it really appearing explicitly in the legislation.
Billy Hughes, who was in the Labor Party at the time, he jumped around a bit. Quote from this time, Billy Hughes said, "We object to these people because of their vices and of their immorality and because of 100 things which we can only hint at. And our objections are not to be met by the declaration that the Imperial Government will be embarrassed by them. The provisions in the bill would, I admit, keep out the Andaman Islander or the low-caste Hindu, but they would not keep out the Japanese, and I doubt whether they would exclude the Chinese. I do not think they would do anything more than shut out the very lowest type of coloured Asiatic." Now, here you have this kind of classic worry that, we don't like them and they're inferior, but the Japanese and the Chinese, they might actually be quite clever, and we have to worry about that.
Yeah, well, that quote from Hughes goes straight to that controversy I was talking about earlier, whether we should just have an outright ban, which I think you can work out that was what Hughes wanted, or this dictation test, which Hughes worried that the more clever Asian races could get around. Some people like to argue that the Immigration Restriction Act wasn't actually about race. It wasn't racist. It was about, preserving working conditions or preserving a unified body politic for a democracy.
Well, that is their argument. One of the reasons why there was objections to having Chinese labourers was that they'd work for lower wages than white Australians at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. But when you read the text of what was actually said, so the leader of my party at the time, Chris Watson, He has an extended section where he talks about the evils of race mixing in marriage. That's not a Labourist concern. It's not a Democratic concern. It's something that's animated by racial prejudice, by discrimination. But the fundamental mistake that they made, right, is they thought that the Chinese were unchanging, that if you weren't white, there was something inherent in your DNA that meant you just couldn't fit in Australia, that it was a nonsense to talk about egalitarianism with people that weren't white because they couldn't live up to the same standards as us. They had a different values, different ideas, different capabilities, and they were just fundamentally incompatible. The thing that they didn't realise is that the Chinese that arrived in Australia, like every wave of migrants that's come since, adopted Australian values. You know, we changed them. They didn't change us. And there's this great quote from the 1930s from a Chinese Australian who was speaking to a delegation from China who was investigating human rights abuses, frankly, of Chinese Australians in our country at the time to report back to China. And the quote essentially goes, you know, the Chinese change whenever they go. If you drop them in the United States, you know, following the industrial example between them, they become rampaging capitalists. If you drop the Chinese in Singapore, in British Singapore, following the example there, they become contractors with designs on a knighthood. And if you drop a Chinese in Australia, they become labour organisers and agitators for the working man's paradise. And that's the reality of the Chinese experience in Australia. The first Chinese migrant to Australia came as a carpenter and ended up as a publican in Western Sydney.
This fear goes way back. You know, the second governor of New South Wales, Governor King, was told by the Colonial Office he would have to take Fenians, Irishmen, as prisoners in his penal colony. He wrote back a furious letter saying they will not fit in. They can't possibly fit in. And, of course, a couple of years later, he wrote back to say, actually, it's worked out rather well. It turns out if you give people a bit of land and a bit of liberty, they make a go of things. And he said they've actually fitted into the life of the colony. So this is an ongoing thing. Underneath it seems to be an anxiety that, gee, maybe we're just so feeble. You know, maybe our culture is so feeble here in Australia that we can't possibly persuade someone else to change.
I think that's right. You know, it's a fundamental insecurity that we're building something new here and that it's precious and that someone else might destroy it. And, like, I think it's precious, but I think it's powerful. You know, like the Australian ideal, that egalitarianism, it's something that I'm really confident in, you know, and we have confidence of a century of migrants being drawn to it, wanting to embrace it, and succeeding and thriving in our society to all of our benefit.
When those first federal politicians are talking about white Australia and the Chinese migration, how do they talk about Aboriginal Australia? Do they mention it in the same breath, or do they take care to keep those two conversations separate? Because, of course, you know, white Australians were the interlopers, and they're complaining about Chinese interlopers. What's your reading on that?
Yeah, unfortunately, that the social Darwinist thinking led the leaders of the time to draw a continuum from Indigenous Australians through white Australia to Asians. The best example of this is Billy Hughes, who, when giving a speech at the opening of Old Parliament House, explicitly says that, you know, white Australia has vanquished Indigenous Australians from the continent. But if we're not careful about things, you know, the yellow horde will come down and vanquish us. I mean, they viewed this in explicit terms of racial competition.
You were talking about how the Gold Rush Chinese had been, at that point, been in Australia for, what, four decades and five decades by the time you get to the start of the First World War. And one of the legends we remember is the story of Simpson and his donkey. Most people know that story. But there's another story of an Anzac story about a man named Billy Singh who was there. What was his story?
Yeah, Billy Singh's someone that every Australian should know. And he was from sort of central northern Queensland, around where Banjo Paterson wrote Waltzing Matilda, actually. And Billy was a kangaroo shooter. He was a drover. He was a cane cutter. He was the opening fast bowler for the Proserpine Cricket Club. You know, you couldn't get any more Australian legend than Billy Singh. And he arrived in Gallipoli in the trenches, and he was a sniper there. And he was extraordinarily successful, extraordinarily decorated. He is credited with somewhere between 200 and 300 kills, which is a macabre metric, but that was his profession, and he was very good at it. He was injured in combat multiple times. He won the DCM. He was lauded by all of his colleagues, but he died in a pauper's grave with nothing to his name. And I think a big reason for that is because he was a Chinese Australian. And so when we're telling the story of Anzac, we know that Charles Bean, who I think is an extraordinary Australian, and told this story of Anzac in a really Australian way. You know, he put the individual soldiers first in his history. He didn't want to tell the sweeping story of, you know, generals had this strategy or tactic or whatever. You know, he was like, John Smith from outside Ballarat did this at this battle. You know, it was this pretty radical thing to do, and admirable. The problem is that we know from Bean's diaries is that he was also a white nationalist, and he viewed it explicitly as his duty to perpetuate the idea of white Australia. He viewed it as an obligation for him to do that. Indeed, in the official histories of Anzac, he writes that Australia was at risk of racial suicide unless vigorous measures were adopted. So given that context, I don't think it's a coincidence that in a official history that names literally thousands of Australian soldiers by name, in the body text of that official history, Billy Singh is not mentioned.
Did Charles Bean change his views on that?
And this is why I think Bean is such an extraordinary figure, because he saw the errors of his ways during his lifetime. After the First World War, he saw the kind of the extreme end of this racial thinking in the lead up to Nazism in World War II. And he had a Damascene conversion. He changed his mind. He realised he was wrong. And he wrote a series of pieces criticising the White Australia policy, saying that Australia had to change. So in the one sense, I think Bean is this extraordinarily optimistic example of people's ability to grow and change. The problem was, by that stage, he'd already written the official histories, and he sort of set in stone this view of Anzac that's sort of still with us today, that doesn't reflect the diverse reality that it actually was.
So then we come to the mid-60s, mid to late 60s, and after Robert Menzies has gone, Harold Holt, the Prime Minister, dismantles a large part of the White Australia policy. Kind of does it by stealth in a way. Doesn't really kind of make a much of an announcement. Whitlam government gets elected, and they noisily dismantle what remains of it, and proudly saying they're there to put to bury White Australia as a policy, and that's done. And yet, with all that, what were we saying about Australia at the time? Were we saying that we didn't need to change, nonetheless, with having done that?
Well, it's an interesting thing that happened in that Whitlam, you know, buried the White Australia policy. Al Grasby, as immigration minister, literally said, "Give me a shovel, I want to bury it." But immigration rates were still very low through that period. And then through the Hawke Keating government, the immigration program was still oriented towards family reunion. So it was still very white, frankly, in its composition. We rhetorically in the 70s sort of abandoned white Australia, but we didn't see the product of that in our community for a significant period of time. And in my book, I argued that we didn't really see it until Howard radically changed our migration system in the 90s.
What changed when John Howard became Prime Minister?
So Howard changed our migration system in two important ways. Firstly, he reorientated it from a majority family reunion-driven permanent intake to a skills-based intake, and that allowed him to increase the overall size of it. So more people who are immediately productive in the economy could be brought in each year. He also introduced a whole range of categories of temporary migration, so temporary skilled migration, working holiday visas, student study visas, those kinds of things. Now, doing that at the kind of the early stages of a 28-year economic boom in Australia, 28 consecutive years of economic growth, introducing and effectively a demand-driven migration system, meant that Australia's migration rate was very high for the last 20 years. And this was really the first big boom in migration since the end of the White Australia policy.
So that's, I think it's only you and George Michalogenis have ever come on the show and noted that one of the greatest legacies of the Howard years was this gigantic king tide of migration. Because while that might have happened, while the migrant intake shifted to a skills base and greatly increased, how does that sit with the story John Howard was telling about the Australian identity at the time?
And here comes the paradox. So while Howard was radically diversifying Australia's demography, our population, in his rhetoric, he was breaking our ability to talk about it. And after a century of nation building in the image of white Australia, we really did need to talk about it. But Howard, he didn't just say we need to ignore it. He said there wasn't even an issue. He's quoted once saying, "There's no need for the perpetual symposium on Australian identity because, quote, I know what an Australian is and always will be." He wasn't talking about Indigenous Australians. He had this view of Australian identity as though it was sort of carved in stone by Sir Henry Parkes and passed on down to us via, you know, Charles Bean and Donald Bradman, and that was it. You know, the 50s version of Australian identity was it. No more change.
Sometimes if you catch him in a weak moment, he'll admit he's narrow on that stuff. But that passes pretty quickly, and then he'll go back to what he's been always saying about it, pretty much.
Well, I can't speak to whether he has had any personal changes of attitude on these issues, but what I can say is that he was very successful in prosecuting, effectively, culture wars on race and identity in Australia across multiple elections, and he kind of scared my side of politics off talking about it. So we went from this period in the mid-90s of, you know, Hawke and Keating talking about changing identity quite extensively, to a period where we've had, you know, more than two decades of sort of viewing it as a third rail in Australian politics, sort of skirting around it, not wanting to tackle it head on.
The same year he got elected, Pauline Hanson got elected to the federal parliament and made her famous speech, her maiden speech, where she talked about Australia being in danger of being, quote, swamped by Asians. From talking to Asian Australian friends of mine about that time, they remember that as being the year where they were abused on public transport, spat on at times. Wasn't a good year, was it?
No. It's certainly one that had a big impact on me, my family. I say to colleagues in Parliament, like, never forget that the words we use in Parliament House will soon be in the mouths of bullies in schoolyards around the country. You know, what we do in our politics, what we do in Parliament House filters down throughout society. And Pauline Hanson injected something really ugly into that discourse in the 90s, and it had a direct personal impact on tens of thousands of Australians.
Interestingly, we had, you know, relatives in Singapore ringing up saying, is it safe for Asians to walk down the street now? Now that some even had this idea in their head that she was Prime Minister of Australia and somehow that she was running the country. And we also found this in India as well. After Indian students had been attacked, there was this feeling that it's not safe for Indian people to be in Australia as well. There seems to be like a real quickness to believe exaggerated, like, you know, there's racism here and there's violence here, but this readiness in the region to see us in that light. What do you think of that, Tim? What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I spoke to dozens of Asian Australians writing this book to try and get their view on this. And one of the people I was speaking to was Tim Soppomason, and I sort of, who was our former racial discrimination commissioner. And he used to say that the thing that would drive him most crazy about his job was people were constantly asking him, you know, is Australia a racist country? And it's a bit of a nonsensical question. You know, you don't see other countries going around having that conversation. Like, yes, there are absolutely varieties of racism in Australia, and they're really serious issues. On the other hand, there are a whole range of areas where we do far better on questions of race than other countries do. So, like everything post-Howard, it's become this sort of culture war about are we or are we not racist? But the reality is far more complex, far more nuanced.
When Australian attitudes to migration are measured by public opinion polls, what do they tell us about how Australians feel about this intense wave of migration we've had to Australia that's led to the population to greatly increase and to change the nature of Australia quite substantially?
Yeah, while we're sort of always on the verge of, you know, putting on the sackcloth on issues of race, Australians' attitudes to migration and race are actually really exceptional internationally. You know, the Scanlon Foundation has been looking at social cohesion in Australia for more than a decade. They're the gold standard in social attitudes research in this space. And they've never found a response from the Australian public on attitudes to multiculturalism lower than the kind of mid-80s. And this is through all of the bluster of politics on this issue. Like, Australians are just nonplussed. They're comfortable with multiculturalism. They like it. The other stat that I think really stands out, and this is the Pew Institute did an international survey on this, and they asked people in all kinds of countries around the world, what is important to being truly from your country? So what is important to being truly Australian? And they asked this in lots of different countries. And Australia is about the lowest response you can get to the question of, is it important to be born here to be truly Australian? We're like half of the response rate to the US on that question. The US, the great migrant country, we think it's less important than the Americans think.
Australia, is it racist? Sometimes I think the follow-up question is, compared to what? Mm. I've been in Europe recently, and Europe doesn't just have Pauline Hansons in its parliament. They have people who have actually become elected as prime minister or leaders of their country on the basis of racist policies. That's just happening in a great many places in Europe right now. So why? Why do you think Australia has this attitude where we seem, according to polling, to be less anxious about migration than other countries in the advanced economies.
Yeah, you're dead right. When you compare support for extreme racist policies in our politics, we do a lot better, particularly than Europe. You know, like the kind of Nazi protests in Australia get, you know, maybe couple hundred people max, right? Like usually they're a couple of dozen. You know, in Europe, in parts of Germany, these are like 100,000 people at these rallies. So it's radically different in that respect.
You have Viktor Orban in Hungary, and you have Erdogan in Turkey, and you have the president of the Czech Republic, who got himself elected on an anti-Muslim campaign when there were about five Muslims living in the Czech Republic, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and so Scanlon sort of says that, look, there are people that are very concerned about migration and multiculturalism and identity in Australia, but it never gets much more than 10% of the population. I think the problem that we do have in Australia is that the institutions of power in our country are extremely unrepresentative. So when these groups flare up, they get disproportionate attention because our institutions of power, our parliament, our media, aren't able to call them out for being unrepresentative. They don't know how unrepresentative they are.
Well, this gets to something called the bamboo ceiling. How well represented are Asian Australians in positions of leadership in this country?
Yeah, so this is the bad news about the performance of Australian multiculturalism. We're a very successful multicultural society with monocultural institutions, and our institutions are more monocultural than comparative countries like Canada, the UK, US. At the moment, depending on how you measure it, it's somewhere between 13 and 14% of the Australian population with Asian heritage, which incidentally, I should say, is a larger minority group than African-Americans in the US, for example. But despite being 13 to 14% of the community, Asian Australians represent somewhere between 2 and 3% of senior leadership positions across our parliament, our business, our public service, our universities, our professions, you name it. Yet there's this perpetuation of an idea of what it is to be a representative of Australia, a leader in Australia, that's still stuck in the past, that still, frankly, see someone like me, like a white man. And we've broken down some of that around gender. You know, we've made progress over time, but it's a new conversation that we need to have about diversity and ethnic diversity in leadership.
In the ABC, we had an Asian Australian woman as our managing director for a short while. How good's the ABC been at including Asian Australians in senior leadership positions?
Well, better and worse. So one of the good things that the previous managing director did was actually start counting this. And not just counting that in leadership, but counting it in on-air guests and voices enabled on the platform. The previous MD was very good in saying that this issue mattered, right? So that did drive some change. But it is fair to say that the ABC still has a way to go before it is genuinely representative of the Australian population.
Generally speaking, is Australia gaining or losing appeal as a place for migrants?
That's a really interesting question. The Immigration Department was set up by Arthur Calwell in this kind of populate or perish time. So it was set up with a nation-building function. And it was very good at attracting people to come to Australia in those post-war years. You know, it was very good at building our nation by bringing new people to our shores. Unfortunately, particularly since Howard, we've lost track of that nation-building function of immigration in Australia. It's become a securitised debate. So the focus is on how we keep people out, not what people do we want to bring in and what can they contribute to our society over time. So it's a really good question about, are we competitive as a source for migrants today?
So it's a question like sovereignty of our borders versus nation-building, then, or they're two different imperatives, I suppose, not necessarily against one another, but they're the two different imperatives there.
Well, I mean, you can trace that through the changes of the name of the Immigration Department. Under the previous Labor government, it was called the Department of Immigration and Citizenship, you know, an inclusive thing, building the Australian community, building the Australian body politic. It changed after the last change of government to being the Department of Immigration and Border Protection. And now we have the Australian Border Force as a subset of that. So you can see that kind of inclusion versus excluding type rhetoric there. But the reality is we're going to have to work harder if we want to attract the kind of migrants we've had over the last 20 years. Because frankly, the source countries that we attracted those migrants from are getting wealthier. They're getting nicer places to live. It's not as obvious you'd want to move from Singapore to Sydney now than it was 40 years ago.
The whole thesis of your book is that the way we talk about national identity doesn't mirror the reality of national identity as we have it in Australia. Now, we're having this conversation here and now. But you're in Parliament. This is where these things should be spoken of. What's it like when you try to have these conversations with your fellow parliamentarians? I mean, just putting all the parties aside for one moment. I mean, you talk to people from within your own party and people beyond it. Is there an appetite to have this conversation, even to begin with?
I'll answer that with a story. When I bring classes from my electorate of school kids to Parliament House, it's like my favourite part of the job. You know, I get to show off the thing that I'm most passionate about, like our democracy. You know, come here and see the way our democracy works. I get these kids from Footscray and Sunshine and Point Cook and people at their places in Melbourne's West. And before I speak to them, I walk them past a wall of the photos of all of our parliamentarians. And I sort of say to them, have a look at the photos on the way along, study them, you know, as you go past, and I'm going to test you on them. And after they walk past, I say to them, those walls on the faces on the walls, do they look like our community? You know, even a five-year-old, even a primary school kid can understand that our parliament doesn't reflect our community. It doesn't look like our community. So whether or not our political leaders want to talk about it, it's an immutable truth. It's a fundamental reality. And if we want to reach our full potential as a nation, it's something that's going to have to change.
This has been an amazing conversation. And thank you so much, Tim. It's really been lovely to speak with you.
My pleasure.
Tim Watts's book is called The Golden Country, Australia's Changing Identity. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.